नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा अपारुता ते संगमतस्सा द्वारा ये सोतवन्तो पमुञ्चन्तु सदहान् I would like to speak this evening a little bit about on the topic of the conditioned and the unconditioned. And as we all know, Buddhism as a spiritual path is oriented towards the unconditioned. This is the goal of our practice, is what we're here for. And we know that the Buddha thought that he had realized this unconditioned, that it was a truth. Reality. And when he spoke about it, he was speaking from his own experience. Can we prove that? No. Do we know that? No. But we have a faith, we have a belief that this was the case. Now, of course, it's true that every deep religion has its own equivalent of what it thinks of as the highest good. And usually, that highest good, whatever else it might be called, like the highest good in Latin, the summum bonum, in Pali is called the paramattha, is very often described as being unconditioned. So if we think of God or something like that, and God is typically regarded as being unconditioned. And Maurice Walsh made the, I think, quite useful observation that the idea of the unconditioned was perhaps useful as a criteria for what distinguishes a religion from the various other surrogates or quasi-religious things that form similarities to religion, like, say, various kinds of therapies and psychologies or sociologies and other kinds of doctrines and teachings, which may have their own value, but which don't have a conception of the unconditioned. And so this is something which religions share in common. And the difference, again, as Maurice Walsh pointed out, I think quite acutely, is that while this notion of the unconditioned is shared in common, that the Buddha was quite very careful to leave the unconditioned alone. Whereas in most religions, they feel the need to qualify this notion of being unconditioned with a lot of other qualities, most of which Buddhists wouldn't accept. So, for example, God is not merely unconditioned, but he's the creator of the world. And so from a Buddhist point of view, we see this as being a raising a whole lot of philosophical questions. How can the unconditioned condition anything? So these are the philosophical dilemmas which are wrestled with in the various theologies of the world. But in Buddhism, the notion of the unconditioned is just that. It's just unconditioned. It's not the creative force. It doesn't underlie conditions or anything like that. It's just the ending of conditions. And the Buddha really didn't give it any qualities. He would merely evoke an emotional response to it by using a whole range of similes. It's the harbour, the refuge, the place of safety, the highest happiness, and so on. And so he's using these terms not to really say what Nibbana as the unconditioned is, but to encourage us to practice, to realize it for ourselves. And so this is the third noble truth. This is the goal of all our Buddhist practice. Now, apart from Nibbana as the unconditioned, everything else is conditioned. And as you, if you've got any knowledge of Buddhist history, then you would expect that this is something that the various traditions would argue about, and quite true that they did argue about it. So the classic Abhidhamma disputes was about whether anything else was unconditioned. Everybody agreed that Nibbana was unconditioned, but various Buddhist philosophers and schools argued that other things could be considered to be unconditioned as well. For example, a popular one was space. It was claimed to be unconditioned. And there are various other things as well. Concepts are sometimes said to be unconditioned. The four formless jhanas are sometimes said to be unconditioned. And various things like this. But I think they're all wrong. And the Theravadin school in this respect maintained the teaching that only Nibbana was unconditioned. And I think that in that particular point that they got it right. And A.K. Waters, a great Buddhist scholar, made a very, I think, very observant statement when he said that even though it might seem like this isn't a very abstruse discussion, but it points to a quite radically different conception of the universe, especially the relationship of our spiritual goal with the world. And so from the Theravadin point of view, Nibbana is, as the unconditioned, is quite different to anything in the world. It's quite distinct. So these different ways of looking at this notion of the unconditioned. Now, if Nibbana is the unconditioned, then the world that we live in is the world of conditions. So it's everything that you've ever seen, everything you've ever heard, that you've smelt, that you've tasted, that you've touched, everything you've thought about, everything you've known and realized with your mind, everything you remember, the whole world that you've ever lived in, not just in this life, but in every past life, everything, and not just you, but everything that every sentient being in every world system has ever known, realized, is all conditioned. All of it. And what that means is that these things all depend on each other. In Buddhism, the notion of conditionality is a very complex one. Things are constantly influencing each other in all kinds of complex ways. And as we know, the Buddha mapped out certain kinds of relationships and connections which he felt to be critical. But he didn't try to be comprehensive. He didn't try to describe all the different kinds of conditional relations. That task was taken up by the Abhidhamma and later scholars. But as we know, with the advances of modern science and so on, that actually there are all kinds of conditional relations operating in the world which are entirely unknown to Buddhism in any form. So we shouldn't try to see the Buddhist teachings as being a kind of complete description of the world and the different kinds of causes and so on that's happening there, but we see it as a description of pointing to certain particular important things which are crucial for us to understand for our spiritual practice to progress. Now this notion of connectedness and interrelationship happens at every level, at every stage, from the very smallest, from the level of atoms to the level of the universe. And of course certainly at the level of ordinary humans, where we happen to live. The And when we say things are interdependent, that's so in a radical sense, the very fundamental sense. And that notion can be pursued in all kinds of ways. So, for example, our lives, the life of everybody here, is dependent on a mother and father. It's dependent on DNA and the genes that we've received. It's dependent on our past karma, all of those things coming together just to create our life. But even that is just such a simplification, isn't it? Because it's not just dependent on our mother and father, but dependent on their whole lives and the choices that they made at every step of their life, and on their parents and their parents' parents, and so on and so forth. And as soon as we start to trace these things, they just keep on going back again and again and again. And it's not just dependent on just that one thing. You know, it's not just conception. But of course the whole process of life, being nurtured in the womb, being born, being nursed and brought up, being fed every day, and all of the different things that we've cared for by our mother and father, by whoever cared for us when we were young. All of those things. But they're just the things that we can see, the things that are more obvious. And there are so many other things which are much less obvious. What about the air that we breathe, that we're dependent on every moment? We're deprived of air for just a few minutes. That's it, we're finished. And the air that we breathe is not something that's just happens to be there. The air exists, and air is very complex. It's mixed up. All different kinds of things. It's always changing, it's always shifting. It's blowing across the sky, blowing across the sea. It's being breathed in and breathed out all the time. The air that you're breathing now has been breathed in and breathed out by countless beings. In the sense, the history of the planet. It's been in trees, it's been in the ocean. It's been up in the sky. It's been in the lungs of elephants and wombats and being breathed out again. Our body is composed of, the very cells that we consist of are made of atoms which at one time or another were dust hurtling through the universe that became collected here on the planet Earth, that were warmed by the sun, and which, because of that long and complex process of evolution, gradually produced organic compounds and matter and so on, and nurturing each other, eating, devouring, excreting. You know, we're all built up of excretion. So if somebody says to you, "You're full of shit," you say, "Yes, I know, I am." That's what we're built of. And these atoms don't know about us. The atoms exist inside us. They don't even know about cells, much less about people. And yet somehow the choices that we make as people affect the atoms. They affect the cells. Even these different levels are all interacting. And so when you start to reflect like this, you can pursue in any one direction the chains of causality and conditionality, and it just ramifies. It just goes off and splinters and goes into so many more directions. It's like the roots of a great tree. They're just going further and further into the soil, connecting with more and more different things. And so every time that we breathe in and out, we are part of something else. You can say from seeing from the inside that we're an individual. It certainly feels like an individual. As I'm sitting here, I feel like there's an identity here. There's a meanness to this. This is what I am as I'm sitting here. And each of you no doubt feel the same way. But of course we know this is not really the case, is it? Our skin is very porous, as we're seeing here. Constantly things coming through, water, moisture, various chemicals moving through the skin, being breathed in and out of our lungs. And physically we don't stay the same even from one moment to the next. The cells on the surface of our skin are dying and being sloughed off. So we are participating at a absolutely fundamental level in these infinitely complex webs of causality. We don't exist and can't exist outside of that. Of course, this is where Thich Nhat Hanh invented the term interbeing to describe this. So we don't exist, nobody exists independently. This is a radically true philosophical notion. So when we're practicing the Dhamma, we have to work in this world of conditions. This is the only place that we have. Our goal is the unconditioned. But where we are actually at is the conditioned. Our actual lives are the conditions. Where we actually feel suffering is in this world of conditions. And it's by understanding that and responding with wisdom to this situation, this is how we gradually move towards the unconditioned. The Buddha said that of all conditioned things, that the Eightfold Path was the best of them. And that of all things, either conditioned or unconditioned, that Nibbana was the best. So this Eightfold Path that we're practicing is entirely conditioned from one end to the other. We just recited that in the chant, that one with right view then gives rise to right intention, with right intention gives rise to right speech and so on. It's talking about that these are conditioned. These path factors work together. They support each other. So when we're practicing, we should never despise the world of conditions. We should never look down on it. And I'm very suspicious when I hear people saying, oh, this is just worldly thought thinking or blah, blah, blah. We live in the world. This is the conditions is us. That's actually where we are. We're growing in the soil with our roots spreading out, being nourished on all sides and connecting on all sides with conditions, and we cannot be in any other way. So the practice of the Dhamma means understanding, working with, and responding skillfully to the conditions that we're presented with. And just as the world of conditions is very complex, so our responses are complex. There are different responses needed in different situations, on different levels. On a basic level, we can't practice Dhamma if we don't have any food. That's the most basic condition for the survival of any sentient being. Sabbe sata ahara titika. All beings must rely on food. And even if you go right down to the one-celled organisms, they still eat. They still bring in nutrients through the cell wall, absorb them, and then excrete other chemicals out as well. Even the one-celled organism eats. So, this is the most basic of all conditions. And then the various other conditions that we have, you know, the place to live, and so on and so forth, I'm not going to try to describe them all. You can't describe them all. And just as we're dependent on the physical sustenance, we're also dependent, we're social creatures. We're dependent on each other. And this is something which is agreed upon in all religions or psychologies or therapies or any person who's looked at and considered the mind in any detail, in any depth, will acknowledge that our minds are formed in relation and connection with others. And if we don't understand to what extent that's the case, then we consider, as we were talking just a little while ago, the case of the feral children brought up by animals. And they, children who do get the basic physical sustenance. They get enough food to eat and, you know, they manage to physically survive. But they haven't had they've had some also perhaps some basic emotional connection with the animals that they might live with, but they don't have any higher social development, they haven't developed language, and so on. And then simply ask yourself, are those children able to meditate? Are they able to practice Dhamma? Of course not. They haven't developed basic cognitive skills that enable us to understand the Dhamma and to be able to practice it properly. So these cognitive and linguistic skills are something that we should never denigrate or despise. If it wasn't for language, we could never hear the Dhamma. The Buddha never denigrated studying the Dhamma or taking the time and the care to be systematic and detailed in how one approached the Dhamma. On the contrary, he only reserved praise for those who would take the time to learn and study the Dhamma. This is, again, part of living skillfully in that world of conditions. That these are all part of who we are, part of what it means to be human. And this is why the path that the Buddha taught is not a path of isolated rishis who sit in the caves of the Himalayas like Pacheka Buddha. It's a path of a sangha, it's a community with relationship between people, mentors, teachers, supporters, good friends. Right speech is a factor of the path. So this is all acknowledging that very simple reality that we are conditioned and that we're social creatures, and that this addressing this and developing it properly is part of how we develop the path. And so when we come to meditation as well, meditation is conditioned. And this is everything the Buddha taught right from the first sermon right through to the end of his life. That our success in meditation is conditioned. It's conditioned by our effort. It's conditioned by our understanding. It's conditioned by our behavior, our conduct. Every breath that we take is conditioned. Every moment of awareness is conditioned. It's conditioned by the previous moment of awareness. It's conditioned by the object that the awareness has. It's conditioned by the mental factors that work together to make it possible for us to be conscious. It's conditioned by our history. It's conditioned by language. Every state of consciousness, even if you're not using language at the time, you might be sitting there, your mind perfectly silent and still, just aware, just knowing. That's conditioned mind, and conditioned by language, just as everything else is. Because you would never have started meditating if you hadn't heard of language, if you hadn't heard the word meditation. And you go away and you develop that state of meditation, and that state of meditation is conditioned by the fact that previously you heard teachings on meditation. These are conditioned states of consciousness. So all the way through, as we're practicing the Dhamma, everything we experience is conditions, but the nature of those conditions is changing. It's becoming more subtle, more refined. And gradually more and more things end. And so this is the where it comes to the curiosity or the real paradox of Dhamma practice, is this notion of cessation. Somehow things can end. Actually, in the world of conditions, normal conditions, as we know from the law of thermodynamics, that energy is neither created nor destroyed, but merely transformed from one state to another. So this is how the conditioned world operates. Things transform themselves, rising and falling, something else arising again. But Nibbana is just cessation, just the ending of things. And so to train ourselves to realize that kind of cessation, we just watch the ending of things, be conscious of the ending of things. This is what the contemplation of impermanence means. Watching the aging of things, the passing away, the death of people that we love, the ending of a delicious meal, separation from somebody that we're close to, finishing of the retreat time that we loved so much. All of these things, the ending, we watch those endings and we gradually allow the conditions in our mind to fade and still. And by doing this, we gain an intuition, an inference for what Nibbana must be like. Every time we see something still in our mind, we experience a peace. And that peace is very delightful, very wonderful. And the more we experience that peace, the more we realize, oh, this is the direction that the Buddha was teaching us to go in. What if I was to take the next step, let go of something else? What would that peace be like? And so we take that next step, we let go of that next thing, and we experience that other peace. And so until we've realized the Dhamma for ourselves, we don't know what that final peace is like. We take it on faith, but it's reasoned faith. It's reasoned because we can see those little bits of ending and stilling of things in our own experience, and we can draw out from that towards the complete stilling, the complete cessation, which is Nibbana. And so this unconditioned, even though in one sense is completely different and separate from anything we've experienced, on the other sense, it's actually very similar to things that we experience all the time. And yet when we look at those things that it's similar to, it's similar to things which themselves don't really exist. So this, to me, is one of the marvelous things about the Buddha's teachings that we discussed. Just for example, in talking about the Samanyapala Sutta, the various similes for realizing the abandoning of the five hindrances, and like the being freed from an illness, or escaping or being let out of jail, for example. These kinds of similes, we know what that's like. Maybe don't know what it's like to be let out of jail, but I was recommended once, my best friend told me I should go to jail sometimes, because then I'd know what it was like. And now you know what it's like to be let out. So I regret not following that advice. But being let out of jail or being freed from an illness. We know what that's like. We know what it's like to be sick. We know what it's like to be healthy, to have been freed from illness. And yet, to be freed from illness is actually nothing, is it? It does not actually any particular thing. If you get 100 people who are free from an illness, they're doing 100 different things. They're thinking 100 different things. They're having 100 different kinds of emotions. There's no one thing we can pin down that is that state of freedom from illness. It's merely an absence. So this is the way in which, yes, on the one hand, Nibbana is completely different from anything in the conditioned world. But on the other hand, it's actually very much like ordinary things that we experience every day. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the conditioned and the unconditioned. So I offer this to you for your reflection, and I'd like to invite any comments or questions.
It was a great talk, Pante. I think it was a really honest appraisal of the situation you find yourself in. So thank you.
Thank you, Natasha.
Pante, when you talk about cessation or nirvana, is it the cessation of ignorance and pleasures, or is it the cessation of all, like the mind and awareness?
When I was talking to Star, I was talking about cessation of everything, but typically it's analysed as having that those two stages, yeah. So the arahant in life, the defilements have ceased, the kilesas have ceased, but then the other things are still going. So this is what they call the distinction. The technical term is saupadisesa and anupadisesa nibbana. So saupadisesa means nibbana with something left over. Yeah? And so that's usually understood to be the state of the arahant in this life, or say the Buddha in this life, that there's something left over. In other words, he still has the five khandhas, the five aggregates, which have been produced by karma and born into this world, and they continue for as long as the past conditions are sort of pushing them. But nothing left over is the state of nibbana, the state of parinibbana, when the arahant or the Buddha passes away.
Does that mean no awareness? Nothing?
Yeah. Well, again, this is where you get into problems, yeah? Because if you say there's nothing, all we can imagine is the not being of things that we know. So Buddha was always very circumspect, but certainly, yeah, everything which we've known in the realm of conditions is absent, is ceased. That's what cessation means.
So when you talk about cessation, do you mean the states where there's no feeling and no perception?
That's the meditation. You're talking about the meditation attainment of neither of the ending of perception and feeling. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm trying to whether what I mean by cessation is equal to the state of no feelings and no perception. In a meditative state.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No. That's the cessation or nibbana is something different. So that meditation attainment is always called the cessation of perception and feeling. It's not the cessation of everything. So it's obviously a very profound meditation state, very difficult to comprehend what it actually means. But the thing is that state of meditation is still only temporary.
So when you referred to cessation a while ago, what you're trying to tell us is that the little things that we let go each time?
Mm. Yeah, they're the little cessations, little endings, which always, they all kind of add up, don't they?
Yeah. What can you tell us about the Arahant Samadhi? Is that
same as Nirvana Samapati? Well, from my own experience, according to the texts, it's very. They seem to be different. Yeah, they seem to be different. The Arahatapala Samadhi seems to be a is an actual awareness of something, whereas the Nirodha is a cessation of awareness.
What was the question? I didn't
know. Well, it's starting to get a little bit up there. But the question is, what's the difference between the Arahatapala Samadhi and the Nirodha Samapatti? Arahatapala Samadhi is the attainment of the fruit of arahantship. And it's a bit of a controversial topic, which was discussed quite a lot of detail by in the book Concept and Reality. But it seems to be that there's a state of meditation, a state of samadhi, which is accessible to only to arahants, which they can kind of abide in, which is probably known by a few different names in the suttas, like they're kind of the abiding in emptiness or various kinds of things. And then there's another attainment called the cessation of perception of feelings. So the question is, are they the same? But they seem to be different.
Nirodha Samapatti.
Isn't that what I just said?
You said the eighth jhana, cessation of perception of feeling.
No, the eighth jhana is the neva sanya na sanya. Neither perception nor non-perception. Yeah.
So the cessation of perception feeling is still consciousness?
Well, that's a bit of a controversial point. Unlikely.
Why is that? Because what I understand is the cessation of perception of feeling so shares a self-view that the person ultimately becomes a non-view, at least.
Yeah.
It's just because that's so destroyed. The consciousness is still there.
Yeah, the problem is that conscious, again, this is getting perhaps a little bit more appropriate to discuss it in a sutta class or something, but consciousness is always said to be dependent on nama rupa.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether you can have consciousness which, I doubt, certainly normally you can't have consciousness which is independent of those things. Although, you know, you might also, on the other hand, argue that it's just such an exceptional state that, you know, bends the rules.
But is cessation, can it be perceived, or is it only inferred after it's happened?
Ah, that's a good point. It's inferred after it's happened. Yeah. Well, keep on going down this path. There's this kind of knowledge called Pachavekananyana, is reviewing knowledge. And so reviewing knowledge is the kind of knowledge, it's described very simply as being that like someone standing would look down and review somebody who's sitting. Yeah? So it's like sort of standing back from something and reflecting on it. And so there's a process of like reflection and assimilation of experiences. So you've got to have an experience, even if it's an experience of non-experience, especially if it's an experience of non-experience, that just kind of happens. And it's not till afterwards that the mind can kind of reflect on it and so on that you actually understand it. But again, all of these things are merely extensions into a very profound sphere of things which are very ordinary and everyday. Yeah, that happens to us all the time, isn't it? Things happen. We have an experience. You're right there when the experience happens. Yeah, yeah. Maybe you see a painting and it's so beautiful you cry. Yeah, you're there. You're right there with that experience. Yeah, that's happening. But you don't know why it is. You don't understand it. And it's not until afterwards that maybe you discuss it or think about it and reflect it that you come to realize, oh, it, you know, that resonated with me because of this or that.
James, to try to grapple with what you're saying, whether it's just a perception or something in birth. It's so subtle.
Yeah, yes. Sorry, Aya, yeah.
This is for your talk. Does it mean that the unconditioned is actually conditioned?
Ah, yes, that's another very good question.
It all seems, if you can't get to the unconditioned.
Yeah.
You require all those conditions, your body, everything's conditioned.
actual path is conditioned.
The realization of it is conditioned by the Eightfold Path. But the thing itself is not.
It's not, it's not, but the unconditioned is conditioned.
The realization of the unconditioned. Yeah. Again, I mean, that's in a sense that's just sort of slipping out of the problem, but I think, you know, we have to have a certain, you know, we just have to have a certain humility that there are kind of limits to the precision of our language and so on to approach it. Yeah. But you know, again and again, that sounds very mysterious, but it's actually not. You know, the house is not conditioned by the path to the house. Yeah, the house exists.
It
might be. Well, and somebody had to drive all the building materials down the road to actually get there. But let's just assume for the sake of the argument, because it's similarly, the house is just there. So we just walk there. But our arrival to the house is conditioned by walking on a path. But the house is there whether we walk the path or not.
So
it's just a metaphor.
Yeah,
metaphors are leaky. All metaphors are leaky.
What's from the cessation of things, but we know the arising of things, right? Like if I say, if I put my finger of a candle, I definitely know the arising of the painful feeling. It's just I wouldn't pay attention to it when it goes away. Right? It's not possible to know the feeling in a way, it's just because I don't pay attention to it, it's about something else.
Right, exactly, So that's the purpose of, that's why you do anicca sanya and so on, you have to train yourself to notice that ending of things.
Yeah, that's my understanding actually. You want to catch the yes disappearing rather than just sort of happen to do the disappear, you want to actually catch him doing it.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Which is a very profound insight.
Isn't there a social target sees that the marvelous quality of target is he knows feelings as they arise and he knows them as they pass away.
Yeah.
It's a marvelous quality.
Okay, so let's finish up by paying respect to the Triple Ten.
Bhagavato Bhagavato